morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is Mike Colsantino. I pronounced your name right?
Very
Mike?
Good. Yeah, after
and
seven.
We have a guest that we've had on before, Mike. We had him on last year. It's about a topic I think couldn't be more important to our listeners, Mike.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or some of the people in this room. Good morning, Max.
That is also true. I want my Social Security increase.
Exactly. Max Richmond, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm going to do a little introduction here, and then you're going to tell me what I would add to it if you like. We are going to talk about preserving Medicare and Social Security this morning on Democratic Perspective. We have Max Richmond, the lawyer, is a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging and a 16-year veteran of Capitol Hill. Max Richmond is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education membership organizations. Mr. Richmond, who joined the organization in 1989, serves as chair of the National Committee's Political Action Committee, a good PAC board, a nonpartisan committee that endorses candidates for federal office who take uncompromising stands on Social Security legislation, which impacts the aging population. Max Richmond, who we're talking to this morning, graduated summa cum laude from Harvard. Besides that, he knows his stuff. Good morning, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to the program again.
Well, for our listeners, I think, you know, 7 years ago when we started doing a show, one of the first shows we did was about Social Security, and there was an attack on Social Security when we began of trying to privatize Social Security. What I would urge our listeners, if you disagree with us about, oh, I don't know, gun control or women's right to choose or something, you really have to think about your own interests and those of your family when it comes to Social Security. So even if you're a conservative Republican, please try to find a conservative Republican that supports Social Security, because it is your money and is your retirement, and you'll be in a lot of trouble if you don't have it. So under that little speech, tell us about what's developing, Max, with Social Security. What are the newest developments? We had the election of Donald Trump. He's been in office a year or so. And we have a new Democratic Congress,
House. Before I do that, you made a couple of really good points in your introduction about the value of Social Security and the fact that people pay into it. You know, we often hear Social Security characterized as an entitlement program, and that's not really accurate. An entitlement program is basically a benefit that you receive because you're living and breathing. Social Security is an earned benefit, and I thought it was very important that you alluded to that in your introduction. People are buying insurance every time they have a withholding, the Federal FICA, Federal Insurance Contribution Act, from their paycheck, and they're buying insurance in the event that they become disabled, that the working person in the family dies young, and also a protection in retirement when they reach Social Security eligibility age. So it's something that we have earned, and the efforts that you pointed out to cut the program, whether it's by reducing the cost of living adjustment, raising the age for benefit receiving benefits, which is a cut, or privatizing the program. Your listeners in Arizona, and there are an awful lot of Social Security beneficiaries there, have really a vested interest in protecting the program And I often wonder why people even talk about cutting it, when cutting Social Security, when there is so much overwhelming support for the program. And it's Democrats, it's Republicans, it's independents. We've done polls for quite a few years, and there is support of close to 80-85% among all political people of all political persuasions to support the program and to improve the program. So you asked what's on the horizon. There has been a legislation in the Congress to improve Social Security for quite a few years. It's never got any traction. It's been bottled up by the Republican majority. But now, at least in the House, I think we are going to see some action on probably the major piece of legislation that will have some activity, hearings, possibly have a bill before the House in this Congress, would do a couple of things. It's called the Social Security 2100 Act, and it the sponsor is Congressman John Larson of Connecticut. In this current Congress that we're just finishing up, there are about 180 co-sponsors, and this legislation would extend the life of the Social Security program for the rest of this century. That's why it's called the Social Security 2100 Act. It would improve the minimum benefit by about $70 a month. That's not a lot, but if you're living just on Social Security or mostly on it, it is a lot. And it would improve the formula for deriving the cost of living adjustment, the COLA, and lead to a larger and fairer cost of living adjustment that actually keeps up with inflation. So that's what we have been focused on that for quite a few years, and I think I've met with Congressman Larson. He's determined to get this bill finally before the Ways and Means Committee. He's the chairman of the Social Security Ways and Means Subcommittee, and try to get it out of the House and put some pressure on the Senate to face the reality that constituents all across the country want a program that is sound and continues for the foreseeable future and is paid for in a fair way.
It sounds like a moderate, sensible, long-term solution to Social Security problem. Why is there so much opposition to it in Congress? Because, as you said, the American people, certainly our listeners, many of them, and not all of them, depend on Social Security, not only for old age, but if something were to happen to the wage earner in the family without Social Security, I could tell you terrible stories in my family, what happens to a family when the wage earner dies. Where's the opposition for this coming Trump? Is it ideological, or is it just stick in the mudness, or what?
I think it's partially ideological. It's also partially a product of not really recognizing the value of the program. As you just pointed out, a third of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers. Spouses, survivors, disabled children, about 3 million children get by in life because Social Security is there for them in the event the working parent dies or becomes disabled. I find younger people are often more skeptical about the future of the program. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from younger people, well, it won't be there when I retire. And that's not true if we make the kinds of changes the Social Security 2100 bill advocates. And if, for example, what I try to impress on younger people is if you are, as an example, a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children, you have right now, never mind what happens when you become, when you turn 67, which is it will be the age for everybody in a few more years for benefits. But you have right now about $500 million combined in value of life and disability insurance because Social Security is there. A lot of younger people don't realize their survivor benefits disability benefits, children's benefits, and it's only when something bad happens, as you mentioned, in a family that they might hear, well, you ought to check with Social Security.
I think that's a very important point, and I think, you know, Mike agrees with me on this, is that when we talk to younger people, they just don't believe Social Security is going to be there for them. I've heard this many times.
Yeah.
I've argued and discussed this with them. It's very hard to convince them that Social Security is going to be there for them, because they've been, the propaganda has been that it's not going to be. And they're not against Social Security. They have no question about its value. They just don't believe it's going to be there for them. And I think your point that they're already protected by benefits is something that we should, an argument I didn't bother or didn't know to argue with them. But the value is there. And, you know, I mean, I've had close relatives who has lost their father and as children had Social Security benefits to help their family. It's personal with most everybody in the country. And yet there's this intense ideology against the whole idea. And the argument out here a lot of times is it takes away your freedom because you're forced to pay into Social Security from the time you start working. And my feeling is when I was like 18 and started to work, I would never put away savings. I mean, and I think it has to be enforced. And I think pretty much everybody who works has to be part of the system. Or as a voluntary system, it wouldn't work, because if you look at voluntary savings of Americans, they're really not very good, right, Max?
Well, you know, it's really important to recognize how much more vital Social Security is now than it's ever been, because, as you said, private savings, defined benefit pensions have largely disappeared. And more, you know, Social Security was originally by President Roosevelt described as one leg of a three-legged stool, the other two legs being private savings and pensions. Well, those other two legs are pretty wobbly, have gotten much wobblier in the last few decades. So that leg of Social Security needs to be strengthened as much as possible, because more and more people are relying on that because the other legs are not that reliable.
Well, that's it. And part of it, Max, is that it's so important. It's such a foundation. We're talking about legs of a stool. We're talking about a Social Security as a foundation of the economy. We're talking 6% of the GDP. 6.1% is projected for next year of the entire gross domestic product of the United States. We're talking $8 billion in Arizona, and this is a state that runs, we run the whole state on $10 billion. And I'm talking schools, cops, everything. We try to run this state, I should say, on $10 billion. And the Social Security pumps $8 billion into the Arizona economy, $6 billion into the Utah economy, and we're talking ripple effect here. And you probably know more about ripple effect than I do.
Well, you know, we did a study a number of years about the multiplier effect, if you will, of Social Security. And, you know, when that $8 billion comes into Arizona by virtue of Social Security checks, that money isn't saved. That money isn't invested. For almost all of it is spent. It's put back into the economy because people live on their Social Security benefits. And it's very important for states and congressional districts and those who represent them in the Senate and the House to recognize this other aspect of Social Security, the vital nature of Social Security to the economies of these states, every state, every congressional district. But let me go back to your point of why there's this underlying and often a very apparent opposition to Social Security, efforts to privatize it. I think a lot of that is being driven by the financial services industry. If you remember, and I remember well, when President George W. Bush was reelected in 2004, We were in our boardroom, in our office here in Washington, watching the press conference the day after he was reelected, and he came out up to the podium, and the very first thing he said is, I have earned political capital in this race to be reelected president, and I'm going to use that political capital to privatize Social Security. Well, you can imagine, we about fell out of our chairs. The staff realized that we were in for a huge campaign to stop that, and we followed the president either physically or through the media in all of those. He had a plan of doing 30 town hall meetings in 30 states, and he did that. And he could not get a bill through the Congress, I think largely because groups like ours and allies made a concerted effort to explain the value of Social Security and the fact that if it were in the private market, that money were invested in the equities. Think about what Social Security beneficiaries would be feeling in the past week when the stock market dropped precipitously. And the point is, yes, you can sometimes do very well in the stock market, but where is that market going to be when you retire? We don't know. But with Social Security, you know you get a statement from Social Security. You know what your benefits are going to be. You know what the COLA is going to be every year if there is a COLA. It's not there. Sometimes there's no COLA because that formula is flawed. But you know what your benefits are going to be. Everybody, the program's been around since 1935. Every single person that has been entitled to benefits has received their benefits in full and on time. There isn't a program in government that can refer to that kind of a record of success. That program of Social Security has lifted more people out of poverty than all federal programs combined. It's a real success story, and we should be valuing it every day, not trying to undermine it. And when I heard the majority leader in the Senate, after the tax bill that added $1.9 trillion to our deficit, when I heard him say, well, now, after it was passed, signed into law, he said, well, now we've got this huge increase in our deficit. We're going to have to look at entitlements. Where were all these people that voted for the tax bill? And it was almost all Republicans, if you recall.
Right.
Where were they when there was a discussion of the impact of this tax cut on the deficit? They were mute. And now they've come to the realization, apparently, that they've got to deal with that deficit, and the way to do it is to attack Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And that's what we're faced with. Yes, we have a Democratic House, which I think will hold the line, but there's going to be, I feel, an effort to try to address some of the costs of the tax bill by cutting these programs.
Well, as we said, it's been such a clear disinformation campaign by the Republicans, and so we're naming names here. We're not mincing words anymore. For whatever reason, no, we know the reasons. The Republicans, the GOP, has supported this disinformation campaign. A, that Social Security is an entitlement. It is an earned benefit, as we touched, just insurance, just like any other kind of insurance, except it actually pays, and they want to pay, and they're anxious to serve their customers rather than reluctant like an insurance company. This is not the way to try to reduce the deficit. It doesn't work that way.
What's astonishing, Mike, don't you think, is that they complained all through the Obama years about this terrible deficit when the Obama administration was using a deficit spending, extra spending in order to get the economy going. And then when the economy is going just fine, in contradiction to almost every economist's idea, then they created this huge tax cut, which is like pouring 10 cups of sugar in a 1 cup of coffee. I mean, that's what they've done. And then I guess what worried us, Max, is when we heard this stuff from Mitchell, we thought, first, they're going to create this incredible deficit, and I don't remember the statistics, but they've created an incredible amount of deficit this year, more, I think, than ever before.
Well, they're very deliberately. The interest on the deficit is, sometime in the next couple months, is going to be larger than principal.
Okay, so then, and then, Max, the next thing they want is they want to cut Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and they want to use their creation of this giant deficit to do that. And why didn't they spend the money to shore up Social Security, Medicare, improve benefits? Most of the guys I talk to would like to have better Social Security benefits and to figure out some way to do that.
Well, you know, what we come down to in this discussion is priorities and who is going to benefit from legislation. The tax cut benefited predominantly the wealthy and corporate America, did not benefit in any substantial way the middle class or the working class. Now, I mentioned the Social Security 2100 Act and the improvements that could be made. The question that has to be discussed is how are we going to pay for that? How do we get the additional revenue to have a higher minimum benefit, a more generous cost of living adjustment, and extend the program for the rest of the century? So at least, maybe some of those doubters, those who think they're more likely to see a UFO than to get a Social Security check, maybe some of their fears will be allayed by this legislation. The proposals that would extend Social Security solvency and add benefits are financed by dealing with the cap on wages, wages that are subject to the payroll tax. Right now, it changes a little bit every year, but this 2019, the cap will be about $131,000. So up to that point, you pay your FICA tax. It's withheld. It's automatic. If you're self-employed, you pay the employer and the employee side both. After $131,000, no more payroll tax. Why? Why not continue to collect payroll tax? We, as a national senior advocacy organization, would support eliminating that cap. We call
how much
it
would that,
scrap
how much
cap.
Would that add? How much would that add to the program, eliminating the cap?
Right. Politically, that is difficult to do. A more realistic, politically, I'm not saying that's what we prefer, but politically, sure, approach would be keeping the cap at whatever it is, and it does increase a few thousand dollars every year, but keeping it at its current level, but resuming collecting payroll tax, FICA tax. Some proposals have it at $250,000, others at $400,000. And by the way, each of those proposals would improve the benefits for those people who would pay more, who make more than $200,000.
Max, let me understand this. So it would, the FICA would, taxes would stop. The money you're paying to Social Security, Medicare, would stop at, say, $131,000. And then they wouldn't resume until you made over $400,000?
Right. Right.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that one before.
Right.
And what's the advantage of that? Why is that more acceptable?
Well, I mean, you're impacting fewer people, and there are members of Congress from, the East Coast, the West Coast, who would characterize someone that's making $140,000, $150,000, $160,000 as that person is not a wealthy person, and they would want to. Politically, it's more expedient to not include them in what would be more revenue that they would have to, more taxes, payroll taxes they would have to pay. So by keeping it at the current level and starting again at a higher level, 250 or 400,000, you are impacting fewer people. But you can still get enough revenue to accomplish the things that I mentioned. You know, I won't identify this person, but I used it as an example, a very famous basketball player who makes a lot of money. This basketball player, because of the amount of money he makes, stops paying payroll tax halfway through the first quarter of the first game of the basketball season.
Wow.
After that, that's when that basketball player has reached 131,000.
Got it.
After that, no more payroll tax. Now, I have a feeling that this basketball player would be okay with paying at least for the first quarter, the whole quarter.
Yeah.
But the way it is now, the rest of that quarter, the rest of the game, the season, the playoffs, the championship, no more payroll tax. There's something wrong with that.
There is something wrong with that for sure. You know, we haven't nearly exhausted what there is to talk about Social Security, but we want to get Medicare in before.
Right.
And so this seems to be, we just are finishing up, I guess, the open enrollment period in Arizona. It's been extended once again, at least on the state level, to get people to sign up for their Medicare Advantage program. So I always thought, and you're going to, Max Richardson from the Committee to Protect and Preserve Medicare and Social Security, and I'm sure I got that wrong, but that's who we're talking to this morning. Max, let's talk about the difference between Medicare Advantage and the supplement,
right,
and regular Medicare.
Well, you know, Medicare Advantage has become more popular in the last few years. I think about 30% of Medicare beneficiaries opt for Medicare Advantage. And for some, it's fine. For some, it may suit their needs, or they may feel it suits their needs. But the problems with Medicare Advantage need to be revealed to beneficiaries before they make that determination.
That's right.
And that's not what's happening. Their Medicare Advantage has some restrictions over the doctors you can use as opposed to traditional Medicare. There are instances where if you're in Medicare Advantage and you're not in your home area, you're traveling, you may have problems getting coverage. One thing that has come to light recently is if you choose a Medicare Advantage plan and you decide you want to go back into Medicare because you realize that it's not really what you wanted, that you're not that interested in health club benefits or things of that nature, and you decide to go back into Medicare, you can do that, but you will not be able to buy a Medigap policy, a supplemental policy, to cover those things Medicare does not cover. That does not seem right, and in fact, we're meeting with some of the leadership in the House of Representatives this afternoon to talk about that as a possible change in the law.
So let me nail this down because it's so important.
Yeah.
Because right now, so many people in the state of Arizona are switching from a Medicare supplement or Medicare program to Medicare Advantage because that's what the state's offering, and there's even a little subsidy. And this is what I've heard also, but it's either difficult or impossible to go back from Medicare Advantage to regular Medicare after you've been on Medicare Advantage.
Right. It's virtually impossible to go back and to buy a Medigap policy, which so many Medicare beneficiaries need to cover the things that the co-pays, the things that Medicare does not cover.
And, oh, absolutely.
What
for
really
a transplant.
Is concerning to us is this administration and the information they put out before open enrollment, which we just ended nationally on December 7th, does not present. It talks about the pluses of a Medicare Advantage plan, but it does not cover make clear what the disadvantages are. So it's clear that this administration is pushing people to buy Medicare Advantage plans. That's what the insurance companies like, and that's what this administration likes.
Two things I want to mention. Number one, for ASA enrollment, it's to the 15th. Yes, Medicare ended, but I believe for ASA, you have until December 15th. And there are one of the premier hospitals, the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, won't take Medicare Advantage. At least they tell you that on the phone. I mean, if you present yourself to the door, I guess, bleeding, you'll be treated.
They limit the number of Medicare patients,
right,
too, Matt.
They limit the number of Medicare, and they're really not happy about Medicare Advantage, as are many health care providers.
And as I say, we have been, we made a huge effort to make changes in the information that the federal government, the Medicare program, puts out prior to the open enrollment period, so that people would be able to understand what's at stake. Now, we remain concerned. They didn't listen to us. We're going to try again for next year. But the Medicare Advantage plans, there's no question, are getting an unfair advantage against traditional Medicare by this administration. And we understand, I feel, that there are, let me refer to them as political operatives at the CMS that runs the Medicare program, and they've loaded the Medicare handbook with information that is extremely biased and clearly leads prospective beneficiaries towards Medicare Advantage plans and away from traditional Medicare. And now I've been told, I haven't seen this myself, that there are emails coming out of the administration that you cannot distinguish from a government document, a government email, or a Medicare Advantage plan advertisement. That's how stark it is.
Yeah. Why are they pushing Medicare Advantage? I know that for some people there's an advantage to it. We have a supplement rather than Medicare Advantage. But why are they pushing it? Is it all money for insurance companies like Social Security, invest your own money, would bring an absolute avalanche of money to the investment industry in fees?
You know, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly right. This is, as with many things in government and beyond government, it's about money. And, you know, when Medicare Advantage program started, there were those advocates who thought it was a way to get their foot in the door to get rid of traditional Medicare. And as I said, there are some Medicare Advantage plans that suit people, and they should have a right, if that's what they select, to go with it. But they don't have, they also should have full information about what Medicare Advantage, the positives and also the negatives, and also the value of traditional Medicare. Let me just, since we're talking about Medicare, I wanted to get this point in. Medicare is a great program. I don't think you'd ever run into a beneficiary who would say, no, I don't want my Medicare, because people need it and people rely on it and they love the Medicare program. But
yes,
it is not perfect. It has some gaps in it. Medicare does not cover hearing, does not cover vision, does not cover dental. Those are very important for health,
very
and also for safety.
Health.
You know, if you can't hear what your doctor is saying, if you can't, if you're not aware of an alarm, your safety is at risk. Now, there are proposals in the Congress, in the House especially, and in the Senate as well, that would begin to cover these benefits: vision, dental, and hearing. Not totally, but a beginning. And they've been bottled up in the House and in the Senate, and so I think now we're going to see some movement for these improvements in the Medicare program. You know, I meet people, I have done hundreds of town hall meetings around the country, including in Arizona, And often people that are approaching Medicare eligibility age, they assume that they have coverage for dental and hearing and vision, and they don't.
And it's very sad, and they don't, and it's obvious. The hearing, dental, vision, the people.
Mike, I'm one of those guys who goes to Mexico to get my dental work done, for example.
And as long as you're physically able to go, then I'm not.
You're
okay
closer
with that,
to Mexico than some people are.
We are, and I was in this little town in Mexico, and instead of hey, come see the beautiful girls, it's, hey, my dentist is better than the other dentist. And there are hundreds of thousands of people who go to Mexico all the way from Canada for dental work, if you need extensive work. Yeah. So,
but let's talk about
that's a major, so dental is a major gap, along with hearing. And I think you're right. I think people don't know that vision and hearing, they assume that their hearing aids are covered, and there aren't.
Right. That's exactly right. Now, the other point that I think is going to get some attention, I hope it does, is, and I'm sure you all hear about it in Arizona, is the high cost of prescription drugs. And during the Republican primary, I watched, I think there were 17 candidates. I think I watched all of those debates. That was not easy, but I think I watched.
That must have been hard on you.
Yeah, it wasn't quite torture, but it was difficult.
I think even if you're a Republican, 70 debates would be kind of hard on you.
But there was one candidate who said, time and again, I will not cut Social Security, I will not cut Medicare, and that was our president, President Trump. And yet the budgets that have been introduced in the Congress have proposed reductions in Social Security and in Medicare. And one of the key points that was made in that primary campaign, going back to Medicare, was the high cost of prescription drugs. And what I recall President Trump talking about was not just allowing, but mandating the federal government to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies to get the best price for Medicare beneficiaries. That is prohibited now. The 2003 law, the Medicare Modernization Act, that established a Part D prescription drug benefit under Medicare, has a specific prohibition in it so that the government cannot negotiate with the drug companies. This makes no sense. If you have a large employer with a few thousand people, they're going to try to negotiate. But you have an entity representing 35 million people and you're prohibited from negotiating. You know who was in the room when that deal was made, and it was not the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. So that has been on the books now, well, for 15 years. We have tried every Congress to get that changed. As my recollection is, the president was for that change in law on negotiating prescription drugs. But what he so far offered just sort of nibbles around the edges of the cost of prescription drugs, and does not take into account the enormous savings that could be enjoyed by the federal government and by beneficiaries if this White House and this Congress actually did the right thing, and by forcing the government to get the best price possible, brought down the cost and saved a lot of money that could be used to, for example, add a dental benefit, a vision benefit.
It would save an incredible amount of money. It would save Medicare. It would improve Medicare. The insanity of not being able to negotiate with drug companies is almost beyond my understanding. I mean, just the price of insulin alone. I mean, it doesn't cost $600 to produce insulin for a person for a month, and especially when a few years ago they were paying $60. It's insane. One of the things I want to, so what you said is incredibly important and germane to this particular discussion. There's health care, and then there's prescription drug costs. And then as these two things, as we go forward, these two things will be the things that need to be wrestled with. What about Medicare for all? How this is the mantra of the progressives,
right?
And you some people say it's a piece of cake. Some people say not so much.
We have not taken a position as an organization on Medicare for all because we, our members, our millions of members and supporters are almost entirely now Medicare beneficiaries, and we want to make sure that a Medicare for all plan, and we haven't completed our analysis, is not going to negatively impact our membership, and we haven't figured that out yet. Do we believe there should be health care provided, adequate health care for anybody that needs it? Yes. I'm not sure that a Medicare for all at this point is the option that we would select. I know it's the flavor of the month among progressives, and maybe by the time we do a complete analysis, that'll be where we come out. But we haven't gotten there yet. And let me just, going back to our discussion, I remembered a poll that was done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is highly regarded, highly respected among Democrats and Republicans. 92% of respondents in that poll, this was done in 2018, said they favored empowering the federal government to negotiate lower drug prices for people on Medicare. And as I said, President Trump made a campaign promise to enact this kind of policy. So far, that hasn't happened. But I think that would be a game changer in terms of bringing down prescription drug costs, which you hear that complaint wherever you go. The cost of medicine is so high. I believe that we, the United States, is the only industrialized country that does not allow their government to negotiate the cost of prescription drugs. Pharmaceutical company is literally getting away with murder. These are life-saving drugs that people often cannot afford and cannot use.
I think you make two excellent points. The solution to Social Security, at least a decent sort of solution, is fairly simple, and that's raise the level of that the money is collected for the FICA. And a solution or a really helpful thing to do for Medicare is just to negotiate the drug prices with the drug companies. And yet we don't do either one of those things. We're about out of time, Mike.
Yes,
we got.
We want to. This is a really important topic. There's all kinds of things to discuss on Social Security, on supplemental benefits, and on Medicare. These are the things that maintain us as human beings in the United States. This is a part and fabric of our existence. And so these kinds of, we want to have you on again soon, Max.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate the opportunity very much.
We've been talking to Max Richmond, who is the chairman and CEO
I'm going to get it right.
Preserve Social Security and Medicare.
National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare has been brought to you today by Democrats of the Red Rocks. We want to throw that in, these wonderful people that support our show.
And all our donors, we very much appreciate your donations.
We
really appreciate regular.
Hey to John O'Donnell, hey to Jim Ledbetter, we want to say hey to Steve Stegner, we want to say hey to Cactus Kate, and I'll see you soon.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.